Committee on Environment in to order for April the 7th. And we are going to do a reconsideration and a work session on House Bill 2593 first. So I'll entertain a motion from the Vice Chair.
Do you want to open a work session?
I'm sorry. Yes. Open a work session on House Bill 2593.
Mr. Chair. I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which the committee sent House Bill 2593 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, requesting that the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee be rescinded.
I have to admit that we were a little hasty in moving this along to the floor. When we presented it to the speaker, she really wanted it to go back this way. And I appreciate for you, Mr. Barrows, that you wanted to see this move as fast as possible to get to avoid the possibility that our sister state to the east might take away, might eat our lunch, essentially. So, do I hear any objections? Any discussion? So ordered. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Now I move that the committee actually reconsider the vote by which it sent House Bill 2593 to the floor with a due pass recommendation requesting that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Again.
I move that the committee pass House Bill 2593 to the floor with a referral to Ways and Means. So we actually are passing it to Ways and Means then, not to the floor.
Directly
Let's
to Ways and
Means. Amend that motion. I move that the committee pass House Bill 2593 and refer it to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Any objections?
Can't trust the scripts anymore.
Well, I did get the script approved by Ramona.
That's right. This is right.
It worked.
The script was right. But the question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
In the motion, the motion was to pass House Bill 2593 to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Do we want to have a favorable recommendation with this, or do
from
we
the
want,
committee.
Or do we want it to be a non-entity as far as a recommendation?
Mr. Chair, it was my intention that the word "pass the bill" meant that we looked upon it favorably, but if the good representative thinks it should be more explicit, I think that's a good
idea. As you know, I think, Representative, sometimes we give courtesy votes to move things along in the process here. And as I recall, our discussion was all positive on this, and I think our recommendation should be positive to
yes.
the Ways and Means Committee when they hear the bill, too. I would just suggest, Mr. Chair, if I might amend the motion here. When we move
amend the amendment, really. Do you want to withdraw your amendment? Or no, let's hear
it. It's a main motion.
Okay.
It's a motion.
I move that the committee pass House Bill 2593 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Any discussion?
I'll take that as just a friendly amendment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative.
Any discussion?
This is more
Any objections? All right, I think we will call a roll, please.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
We're excused.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Chair Anderson?
And the chair votes aye. With a constitution majority, we have passed House Bill 2593 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Dave.
Substitute to me sounds like after the four.
I think it is correct. That's what I'm going to say. Yeah.
All
right, yes, Representative Lynn.
I don't believe this is a constitutional majority. This is for by rules, I think.
Could be.
Okay.
I've heard that used in other committees. That's why it is.
Whatever I had yesterday, you've caught today.
Indeed.
We had a fun time in Land Use. All right, I'm going to open an informational meeting now on the overview of the natural gas system. And our first panel we'll call is Gary Bauer and Dan Kirshner and Jim Anderson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural, and we appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon to have a discussion on the natural gas supply and energy policy issues. Northwest Natural is a natural gas distribution system. It's located here in Oregon. We have 550,000 customers and 50,000 customers in southern Washington. But in order to give you kind of a good overview, we've asked Mr. Dan Kirshner, who's executive director of the Northwest Gas Association, to give the presentation, because you'll quickly realize that natural gas moves not just between states, but between countries, et cetera. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan, and I think Jim Anderson will follow up after that with some additional comments.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome, Dan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here today. I have prepared a slide presentation for you, so I direct your attention to that. And I'll try not to read from the slide presentation, but rather let the graphics speak for themselves and perhaps embellish a little bit with some words that will help flesh out what you see up on the screen. This first slide just describes our service territories, where the members of the Northwest Gas Association come from. I believe staff has already distributed to you our briefing booklet, so you have that up there, and I don't need to spend much time on that, other than to say in January we've added a ninth member, a sixth distribution company, and that is Terrison Gas, which serves virtually all of the natural gas in BC, in British Columbia. So among our six members and the three transmission pipelines that bring gas to and through our region, we serve virtually 99.5% of all of the gas that is consumed in the Pacific Northwest. There are three small public gas utilities in Washington State: Enumclaw, Ellensburg, and Buckley. And if you know anything about them, they're not very many customers there. So our members do represent the vast bulk of the natural gas industry here in the Pacific Northwest. It's important that we have this discussion and that perhaps we set some context here. In the Northwest, when we say energy, we typically mean electricity. And in many cases, we often mean hydroelectricity. But to set the context here, in fact, natural gas is a very important energy source in the Pacific Northwest. And what you see here are four lines that describe that issue. The two orange lines describe electricity consumed in the Pacific Northwest, and the two blue lines describe natural gas consumed in the Northwest. The first orange line, the lighter orange line, is that electricity that is provided to the region by the BPA, which provides about 45% of all of the region's electricity. And the light blue line then describes the energy consumed in the region via natural gas as an end use. That is to say, all that natural gas that's consumed for purposes except generating electricity. And then the darker orange line describes all of the electricity consumed in the Northwest, and the darker blue line then describes all of the natural gas consumed, including gas used to fire electrical generation. So you can see that natural gas is a very important energy source in the Pacific Northwest, notwithstanding our wonderful hydropower legacy. I did want to take just a minute of your time to talk a little bit about how we have used gas in the Northwest and how we are going to use it. This study that I am drawing most of the information from here is developed by the Northwest Gas Association and includes, a historic look at demand, supply, and the infrastructure necessary to link the two, both, historically as well as prospectively. So this is how we have used gas over about the last 10 years. And you'll note that through the 1990s, that growth was pretty steady until about 2000, when you see that top maroon bar there, which represents industrial consumption, take quite a shrink, and that is because in large part of the Western energy crisis that we had and very high spiking natural gas prices, industrial consumption dropped off pretty dramatically. You'll also note the yellow bar in the year 2000, a pretty wide expansion of gas use for electrical generation. That was because at that time it looked like we were operating in a deficit of electricity, ability to supply the region with electricity, and natural gas is both quick to bring online and clean, and so it was a preferred source, and we generated quite a little bit of electricity. Then following that, of course, we had a pretty significant economic downturn and other issues, including warm weather. You'll see down there in the residential bar, the dark blue bar, a decline over the last couple years, attributable predominantly to warmer weather over the last few winters. And please feel free to interrupt me and ask any questions as we go along. This is what we think the growth is going to look like for the next couple of years, and we're in the midst of updating this study. We'll release an update in June or July of this year that takes a look out through 2010. But you can see pretty steady growth in each of the sectors, nothing very dramatic, tracking predominantly economic and population growth in the region. Now I want to just shift gears a little bit to supply, and we're going to start by taking a look at those supply basins that upon which the region depends, and you'll see two of them described here. The first is up north of us, and it's called the Western Canada Sedimentary Basin. Most of it resides in Alberta, but a big chunk of it, a good chunk of it, where there's a lot of growth going on in northeastern BC, and then of course several supply or production areas in the Intermountain West down there, Rocky and the like. I like this slide because it demonstrates two things. One, how we are located geographically to these supply basins, which is right next door, and two, how well connected we are by virtue of transmission pipelines to both of these supply basins upon which we depend. This is just a table that describes the potential, and I'll talk a little bit more about proved reserves in just a moment. But if you were to do the math there and take that production level in 2002 of 23 billion cubic feet per day and divide it into the ultimate potential of, into the proved reserves of 94 trillion cubic feet, you'd come up with a supply of about 11 years, and I'll just do that math for you. But it's important to note that those proved reserves really are what I would refer to as a working inventory. That is to say, they are those reserves that are available to the market pretty much immediately. And this graph really describes that those proved reserves grow over time. They grow as the need for additional gas grows, as the economics and gas prices go up, we're able to go out and find and prove up more reserves. So what that really is, as I say, a working inventory. And you may ask the question, rightfully, well, why such a long-term working inventory? Why 11 years worth of gas on the shelf, if you will? Well, because it takes quite a bit of time to develop new reserves and the infrastructure necessary to bring them to market. So it's not like your widget, for instance, that resides on the shelf and you can just ramp up or ramp down very quickly. It takes time to bring this stuff online, so the industry typically keeps a fairly large working inventory. This is what production we think is going to look like over the next few years in our northern supply area. And you can see if you take all of those lines, it's fairly flat. We're working hard to keep up. That doesn't mean that there's not enough gas in there. It just means we're having a hard time getting it out of the ground to keep up with growth in use. And I did want to describe that most of the growth we're going to see in the basins upon which we rely, we expect we'll see in the Rocky Mountain region. And this describes that growth. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the continental supply picture, and I'll tie this together for you in a few slides as to why it matters, why the continental picture matters to Northwest consumers. This slide simply describes where some of the production areas, most of the production areas are in North America. It also describes those that are growing, both absolutely and in percentage terms, as well as a couple that appear to be declining in their productive capacity. Now today, this is where the U.S. gets its gas. You'll note there that term quads stands for quadrillion BTUs. And you'll note there that we get most of our, about 85% of our natural gas in the U.S. comes from domestic sources in the lower 48, about 18.7 quads, if you will. We get about 3.3 from Canada and another little bit out of LNG from markets overseas. LNG, liquefied natural gas. If I lapse into speaking in acronyms, please interrupt me and ask me to explain. In the year 2020, this is where we think we will be getting our supplies from. And you'll see there that there's really very little growth, some, but very little growth in the lower 48, up to 19 quads. And in fact, we lose a little bit from Canada, large part because they're going to need to meet their own needs. And there is a large oil deposit up in Calgary where some of this gas is likely to go to help produce that oil. But we're expecting significant increases in imports from overseas via liquefied natural gas and the addition of gas coming to us from Alaska. It's important for me to note at this point in time that that gas that we expect to come from us to us from Alaska is being produced today as a byproduct of oil production that is going on up in Alaska. In fact, they're producing something over 6 billion cubic feet a day of gas up there and simply reinjecting it back into the ground because there is no place else for it to go. So the idea behind building the Alaska Gas Pipeline is to give an avenue for that gas to get to markets and hopefully moderate some of the volatility and the higher prices that we've seen today. So this is what we're hoping for in 2020, indeed what we expect. And this just describes some of what we're seeing. Because we don't have access to new sources of supply or new areas in which to explore, we're putting more straws into the drink, if you will. So we have existing supply fields, and we continue to drill more and more wells in them. The production on each of those wells then declines, as you might expect. So we're spinning, drilling more and more just to keep pace.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm having trouble reconciling the slide to what you just said. Mm-hmm. It looks as though the production is declining. Now, did I misunderstand that?
This is production per drilling rig.
Okay.
So we're putting more rigs in the same fields, and as a consequence, they're generating less and less gas each.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chair, another slightly different topic. On the last slide, that slide before last, you showed about 18-plus quads in the lower 48. Mm-hmm. On the next slide, you showed 19 quads 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. How long do you expect to be able to produce in that neighborhood of natural gas from the lower 48?
You know, I don't have the ultimate reserve number in front of me, but what I'd like to do is be able to get back to you with an answer to your question, if that would be all right.
Do we get a deep fall off after 2020, or is it go out a ways after that?
You know, again, I don't have the answer to that question immediately, but most of the studies I've seen demonstrate that this can be sustained over a period, over a pretty good period of time. That at existing production levels, for instance, production levels today, we've got about 60 years worth of gas at today's production levels. Now, I want to come back, as I say that, I want to come back and note that as prices go up, and new technologies become available, and the like, we find new supplies.
Sure.
So that, that may grow in itself over time. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, very good,
Chair.
Okay. Moving on, and this is the slide that ties it all together. This is really, in my mind anyway, why the continental gas picture is relevant to Northwest consumers, and it's a slide I like to call that great big sucking sound going east. You can see that the orientation of gas supplies and gas flow in this case is eastward, which is really no surprise where the population centers are. But the result of this is because we are an interconnected North American market, consumers in the Pacific Northwest will pay the prices being paid for gas by consumers in the North East and Midwest and the like. And indeed, we're subject to some of the volatility that they experience. So if they experience in New York or Massachusetts a significant cold weather snap, we can see the prices here in the Pacific Northwest increase because of this interconnectedness. I did want to take just a minute of your time to explore a study that was very recently released by the American Gas Foundation. And it describes consequences, policy consequences, or consequences of three policy scenarios. The first being that the status quo, what we have today, if nothing changes from what we have today, what we can expect the consequences of that policy to be. It also describes what we think actually is going to occur given today's environment, and a scenario that describes what could happen if we're a little more aggressive about improving natural gas supplies, conservation, and the like. And you can see here that the scenarios are described. In essence, existing policies include no change in the drilling moratoria on offshore areas, east and west coast, no change in access to non-park Intermountain West lands, the Alaskan pipeline is not built, and though we do experience an increase in LNG, it's not as dramatic as we think it will be ultimately, and that we continue to use rely on natural gas as a primary source for new gas-fired generation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Garrard.
Dan, on the slide before this one, the gas that's coming from the western side of the United States and being piped back east,
mm-hmm.
don't we tap in and take the gas to the western section of the country before it goes back east? So how do we wind up paying for gas that we have nothing to do with back east?
The gas will go where it's sold. And what this tells you is that the network, the interconnectedness of the market, means that gas can move as easily east as west. So so that bids the price up, if you will. Now they'll sell to the highest bidder for that natural gas, and then they're able to ship it where it's bought. So it's not necessarily a case of the western states get to buy it at a different rate, although I will say that by virtue of us being the closest market to these supply fields, we do have an advantage in terms of we don't have to pay as much in transportation costs. But the commodity itself, it's everybody's game.
So there's, in essence, a
foul, Mr. Chair?
There's, in essence, a net and gross charge on the gas, the gross equaling transportation charge for that gas that comes from the west and goes to the east, and companies like Avista and Northwest don't have to pay that. In other words, they're just bidding on a bulk price for the gas, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural. Natural gas is a traded commodity, and so it's basically, it can be traded, and prices are kind of across the country. So that's what Dan was trying to talk about in terms of the price. We, for Northwest Natural, buy gas out of British Columbia, Alberta, and the Rockies. And so we pay for that gas. We then pay an interstate pipeline system, which is owned by another entity, to move that gas into Oregon or southern Washington, where we then take that gas off their system and move it into our pipeline. But we have to pay them. There's a whole different series of charges. You pay them a firm capacity charge. You may have interruptible capacity on their pipeline, which means that if for some reason they can knock you off to take somebody else in, and there's various levels of charges associated with that. I don't know whether I'm helping you or confusing.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
I'm just trying to tie the East Coast demand into the West Coast price.
Again, Mr. Chair, it's in a grid. It's a traded commodity, and so just as if you were trading oil or wheat or something else, you know, the price of the commodity is subject to purchase across the United States.
All at the same price.
No, there never is going on at that point in time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, there are different trading areas. For instance, if you'll note down in the lower right kind of quadrant of the of that chart, there is a large flow area that kind of represents what's called the Henry Hub, which is actually where the New York Mercantile Exchange, also called NYMEX, does most of its trading. And that is the benchmark for the industry, where everybody kind of compares against what's the price being paid at NYMEX for NYMEX for futures and the like. And I will say that we trade in a couple of different places up north there in Alberta, where you see that one little good line coming down. That's AECO out of Alberta. There's also one in the Rocky Mountains, Opal, and one at the Washington, D.C. border called Sumas. And typically those prices do trade at a bit of a discount to the NYMEX hub, 50 cents to, or in that range, and it changes on a daily basis, but it's not dramatic. It's not like it once was when, for instance, 6 years ago, if you were to look at this chart, the flows would be entirely different. That northern flow that you see heading east was not in place 6 or 7 years ago before the Alliance Pipeline was built. And some of those flows from the Rocky Mountains also back east, there have been new pipelines put in. As a consequence, those supplies in Alberta, BC, more, and the Rockies were kind of captive to the markets that they had access to, which included the Pacific Northwest. We paid significant discounts for our gas at that point in time because it couldn't get anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Okay? Does that help answer?
Yes, it did. Okay. Thank you very much.
So we've talked a little bit about these scenarios, and I wanted to just describe for you then, under each of those scenarios, the existing or no change policy, the expected policies or expected changes, and the expanded policies, what we can expect the supply mix to look like according to the American Gas Foundation again. And you'll see under existing policies, increase in lower 48 production, which translates to much more pressure on those supply areas, some increase in Canadian supplies and virtually no LNG, and of course we did say that the Alaska pipeline would not be built under that scenario, but you also see an overall reduction in demand. That's as a result of higher prices and the fact that industrial consumers cannot withstand those kinds of higher prices, and so demand will come out of there. So moving on then, we can talk a little bit about what the price scenario will look like. This is in nominal dollars, which is important to note, but you can see that under existing policies, if no change, the Alaska pipeline isn't built, LNG doesn't come in the volumes we think it needs to, we're going to be paying something north of $13 per million BTU for natural gas in 2020, as opposed to something a little over $6 under our expected policy scenario and something under $5 for our expanded policy scenario. So pretty significant impacts. Kind of drives us to, I think, a dual solution. One is we should be looking to use this resource as efficiently and effectively as possible and conserve it where appropriate. And secondarily, the need for additional supplies for our economic interests. So I won't spend much time on that, but I did want to take just a little more of your time to describe how we link then supplies and our capacity to link supplies to demand in the region. And this is just a chart that describes significant infrastructure facilities that we have in our region, and you'll hear from one of our interstate pipelines here in just a moment. This is the average capacity on an average winter day, average weather, which we've not experienced the last couple of years, but average weather, how we fulfill that supply. And that big blue bar down there is pipeline capacity. So you can see that we meet most of our demand, base demand, if you will, with pipeline capacity. And then that white space there, circumscribed by the red line at the top, describes that supply that we provide through underground storage that resides in the region and LNG facilities that we already have in the region. We haven't had to build any. Some of our member companies own some what are called peak shaving facilities, and they use that liquefied natural gas on the very coldest of days to fill the last measure needed to ensure that their customers continue to keep warm. Okay. This describes what happens on a peak day, what we anticipate our peak day to be. The peak day is the coldest day that we might expect, and the planning criteria are different for different companies, but they're typically around the coldest day in the last 25 or so years. There's a range there. Some use a more aggressive peak day calculation, some less. But these are peak days, and you can see what this slide tells you is that our system is beginning, in order to serve peak day needs, that very cold day, we're beginning to lose a little flexibility in the system. And in fact, we've seen through integrated resource plans or least cost plans developed by the utilities in the region, which describe how they intend to meet demand, we've seen that they are planning to tweak their supply capacity upstream, purchasing additional capacity, or in some cases expanding storage and storage deliverability. In Northwest Natural's case. Okay? So, and I will say that on this slide, it does describe kind of a diminishing of flexibility, but we were very aggressive in our demand projections and quite conservative in our capacity projections. As an example of that conservatism, we assume that it is going to be the coldest day in 25 years everywhere in the region, from Vancouver to Boise, Seattle to Spokane to Portland, and in Northern California as well. So it's a pretty conservative estimate with regard to capacity. Okay? This slide just simply demonstrates some of the expansions that have occurred recently in our infrastructure capacity, and those expansions occur on a basis of system utilization. So when we start running out of room on the pipelines, those folks who need capacity on the pipelines go talk to the pipeline operators and say, we need more. And it expands, the market drives those expansions, and that causes a more efficient allocation of capital, and it's worked pretty well. We don't overbuild the system.
I assume TCPL is TransCanada?
TransCanada, yes.
And Duke is American or Canadian?
Well, they are headquartered in North Carolina. As you know, it's the Duke that you're familiar with, but they do own this Duke Energy Gas Transmission and field services in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We've gone through some of that. I do want to just highlight for you what's changed in the last few years in the Pacific Northwest. And as I indicated earlier on, we did at one time have a significant surplus of gas. We were able to produce more gas than we were consuming through the 80s and 90s, and that resulted in very low prices and very stable prices for not only Northwest consumers but also North American consumers. That's changed. We've used that capacity up, and we're now consuming the gas as quickly as we're producing it. And as a consequence, we have price volatility and sustained higher prices that we've seen over the last couple of years. The markets are interconnected, which wasn't the case for Northwest consumers seven or so years ago. And as a consequence, we are exposed as consumers to those market drivers that occur in other parts of the continent. And finally, I just want to note it has become more difficult, more strenuous. It's not a critique, it's just an observation, to get required energy facilities, pipelines, and the like, LNG facilities, to get those permitted. It's just, again, an observation. Finally, I just say, More supply is certainly required, as is additional conservation and efficiency measures. Very important. By and large, the natural gas market is a well-functioning market. Seems as though demand, supply, and infrastructure capacity do respond to market signals, higher, lower prices, and the like. And ensuring that we have the energy we need to keep plowing ahead in the future is going to require that our industry's planning processes are as aligned as they can possibly be with regulatory and permitting processes. And with that, I'll offer myself up for questions.
All right. Questions from the committee? Representative Bloom.
Thank you for your presentation. And what's the, in the resolution is mentioned, we are one of the highest in the world market. And where is the comparison?
I am not, maybe one of my colleagues here can, or even TransCanada could help answer that question. I'm not real familiar with the global markets for natural gas, but Japan uses gas significantly in China, Russia, Europe. There's pretty significant supplies, and I'm not familiar with where they're traded or at what prices.
I'd like to have that information.
Yes, sir.
Someone else, or
okay. We'll get that to you.
Yeah, any questions?
And one more follow-up.
Please.
Are we doing this, our state, or are you doing this resolution, the memorial, the nationwide each state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, actually the Matt Marquis will describe the memorial, I think, after we're done. It's his or one of his clients that is bringing the memorial forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. A couple questions that I had. You mentioned that we are using more and more for electricity. It had been home heat and air conditioning, I assume. Strategically, where should we be going? Should we be going to more generation of electricity, and or should we be saving that, using it more for individual home use through just the gas itself?
Well, let me answer that question two ways. First of all, there are not a lot of better options today than natural gas for new electrical generation. It is the cleanest emitting fuel. An alternative would be coal, nuclear, or additional hydro, and of course wind, and other alternative energy sources are clearly a part of that mix. But when you look at large scale generation on the neighborhood of 250 or 500 megawatts, or the Trojan plant I think was able to produce 1200 megawatts, for instance, you're talking about one windmill per megawatt, and then that power is available about 30% of the time. So wind is a very important part of the solution, but not the solution itself. With regard to then should we be using electrical generation, it's the best option available today. It doesn't cost much, relatively speaking, to some of the other options. To put it together, it's very clean emitting. I think this is a place where potentially we ought to be looking at, and this gets to the second part of your question, where we ought to be looking at how can we use that resource most efficiently. And in fact, in the Pacific Northwest, we heat homes. We heat fewer homes, proportionally speaking, with natural gas in the Pacific Northwest than is done typically across the rest of the nation. Again, part of our hydropower legacy and that thing that we're all thankful for. But we had a lot of electricity for a long time. And as a consequence, the first option was to put in electric baseboard heat and electric water heat. And so maybe there's an opportunity there for us to take a look at how can we provide for more efficient use of that gas resource first, and then once we've used up all the generation, hopefully there are other options available to us. Again, wind and other alternative sources are important, but gas remains a viable one. I will say one other thing. Gas has become a little bit less attractive to power producers because of the volatility of gas prices, and because the fuel, the marginal cost of producing gas, is pretty expensive. So, Did that answer your question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
So, tell me, do you have any access to the figures of comparison? What it takes, I've seen 5 cents a kilowatt, or 5 cents in comparison for the West Coast power cost as to 10 or 14 cents on the East Coast. What is that, 5 cents per?
Mr. Chair, probably kilowatt hour. I believe kilowatt hour, which is a measurement of your electric usage.
Okay. How would production of electricity by gas, as opposed to, say, wind power or even hydro, where do they stack up? What, do you have any information on that?
I can generate that information for you, and the best I could give you today would be kind of an educated guess, which my wife has cautioned me against doing, so she teases me
about
that.
At least it'll give us a kind of an idea relatively.
Yeah, I'd be happy to generate some information for you and get it to you or staff.
That'd be great.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Sure.
Another question I had, excuse me.
I just comment that I believe the Oregon Department of Energy could also generate information for you.
Yeah, okay. In terms of permitting, is the gas industry looking at building new plants here in Oregon?
One? there are, I'm aware of, I think, 4 or 5 liquefied natural gas facilities that are under consideration. Some are further along than others. Some are pretty speculative, and others, as far as I know, are actually moving along the process. Beyond that, I think I'd have to defer to Gary on that, Mr. Chairman, if they're planning anything.
Mr. Chair, the only other plans we have in the works right now actually are our expansion of our mist gas fields, and it's basically to expand the storage capability at that location.
Not for greater production capacity?
taking the bulk of the gas out. You know, what's left is kind of low-quality gas, and so we continue to blend that in when we draw out the our reserves that we pump back in, but not a lot of expansion in terms of a new resource at that location.
Well, is it more efficient to produce electricity at the point of use, or to produce it in Alberta or BC and ship it down to high-power lines?
I think I will pass on that. There's others. I mean, I used to do some work in the electric arena, as did Jim. But I think we've both been out of it for a few years, so maybe David Stewart Smith is here from the Department of Energy. Probably just love the fact that I offered him up as a resource for you.
Okay. Then I guess I probably better not ask this last question either. Just want to talk a little bit about permitting here in Oregon, so that's not really your bailiwick. Okay, did both of you want to summarize it all?
Just Jim Anderson with the Corporation, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a couple of things to bring up, and I'll be brief. I'm not going to try to embellish upon what Mr. Kirshner just did.
Maybe I could break in. We did have a question that I overlooked.
Oh.
I didn't know if Representative Barnhart also had a question,
too. Okay, Representative first.
Okay. Your pipelines are vulnerable. What are your concerns in regard to sabotage and terrorism?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, there are, I think, parts of our pipelines that are vulnerable. By and large, they're underground. I mean, they're 5 feet underground or so. We do have some significant concerns, and in fact, we're pursuing some of these up in Washington State with regard to protecting the information that may be publicly available. But you know, locational information at the facilities would be pretty hard to get to, but of course nothing is too hard for a determined terrorist.
As a county commissioner in Klamath, and obviously you know you've got the end of one of your lines in Lynn, which is in my district, yes. And in Klamath County. During my tenure, 4 years as a commissioner, on 3 different occasions we had saboteurs trying to blow up that gas line. So that's what prompted the question to you. I didn't mean to give the impression that the whole length of the pipeline was, but but I know that you do have vulnerable parts of it that aren't.
Well, I know that our member companies work very hard at keeping those facilities secure. Part of that is guarding the information about where they're located. And part of that is simply a part of their daily operational programs whereby they patrol both on ground and overhead those, you know, flybys, those facilities on a regular basis and try to keep track of it. Perhaps Jeff Rush with TransCanada can speak more to that and specific security actions that they take to keep those facilities secure.
Because they're pretty easy to spot out in the middle of a potato field.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, Gary Bauer, this has been a long discussion that we've been having, particularly ever since 9/11, and that is that we have both public policies that encourage us and to work with local governments, emergency responders, and now even basically all residences or anybody along a pipeline system, so that they are aware that there is a pipeline in their area. Flip side of that is trying to not have that same level of information available on the internet. Mr. Kirshner just mentioned an issue we have because we operate in Washington is that they actually have a GIS mapping system, and someone just a couple weeks ago requested access to the GIS mapping system, which would give you pinpoint location, and they basically, it was a publishing company that wanted to then distribute that information commercially. We raised a number of issues and convinced them to kind of withdraw their public information request, but we're trying to find a balance between the public's need to know that are in the area but not generate that information so it's just out there on the internet and elsewhere. So it's a fine line we're walking right now with everybody.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of areas. The first one's going to sound a little strange, but it's really a follow-up of the chair's question about where to locate plants. Can you give us, any of you give us some idea about what the loss is through leakage or other attrition in gas lines and moving it from the field to the place where it's being used?
Yeah. I think maybe Mr. Rush could help you with that question when he comes.
The reason I ask that, of course, is because I have some idea of what you lose in high power electrical transmission, and I can compare the two. The other question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is do we have any sense at all at this point where we're going on a supply-demand curve, whether the price of gas is going to increase more than inflation? How's it likely to compare to the cost of renewables over time? And, you know, I'd like an answer to that based, sort of like we're thinking about long-term planning. Mm-hmm. An investor who's going to invest in a gas-fired turbine power plant is going to be investing for 25 or 30 years. What's your sense of it? Is it going to be cheaper to continue to buy gas, or is it going to be cheaper eventually to buy wind power or something else that's sustainable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnard, thanks for the question. I think it's safe to say that, you know, gas is was at one time a very inexpensive commodity, and that today it is on a par with other energy sources, whether they be electricity or wind. In fact, the best way for me to answer that question, I think, is to just describe sort of the behavior of purchasers of those facilities. And what we've seen and Jim may be able to speak more eloquently to this than I can, but clearly what we have seen among some utilities in the region anyway is the need to look at additional gas-fired generation, but the desire to look at alternative energy sources like wind and others, and certainly with the tax production credits that are in place for wind that I think expire actually this year, wind is competitive today at the with gas prices where they are at today. Mm-hmm. We do anticipate, I just direct you to the Energy Information Administration, which delivers this kind of stuff and does long-range gas forecasting, they expect within the next couple of years that increased production of natural gas, that bringing on new gas supplies from Alaska and LNG will bring the price down a bit and stabilize them over time, but then it's going to continue marching up. Did that answer your question, Representative?
Yeah, I think it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we better move ahead. Gary and Jim?
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson again with the Vista Corporation. Thank you. I want to direct your attention to the testimony that was handed out to you from us. It primarily deals with the House Memorial 1, which you're going to consider immediately after our conversation here. But a Vista does serve in this state, and we're the little guy at the table, I guess you could say, compared to my friend to the left, my left. We serve 85,000 customers, a few more than that in the state, in Douglas County, Josephine, Jackson, Klamath County, and Union County. Avista also serves electricity to their customers in the Pacific Northwest. Not in Oregon. We're only gas supplier, distribution gas supplier in the state of Oregon. But Avista does own and operate gas-fired electrical generation up on the Columbia River. Coyote 2, this was a deal that was worked with the defunct Enron Corporation, who started siting a plant up there. We completed the plant, and it is now online. Question was raised earlier by the committee, what is the future of that type of generation? As it was heard in Representative Girard's committee last Friday, on siting issues, probably not looked on too favorably right now by Avista because of, quite honestly, some of the treatment that has been given to it by the state of Oregon. A horse that I beat to death, it seems like every session, is in energy. Energy in the state of Oregon. Oregon imports, is a net importer of all energy sources. Now think of what that does to the cost of energy when it gets to the end-use consumer. That includes gasoline, it includes electricity, it includes natural gas. We do not, or we generate, very little electrical energy in this state that is used in this state. Most of it is imported. And I include import as being Bonneville Power Administration. So it's something to consider when you're considering also the House Memorial 1. But what I might do is direct you to another piece that was handed out, and it is this piece. It's a bill that was introduced yesterday by U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander out of Tennessee. And he is the subcommittee chair on energy to the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. What I'd like to do is I have some bullets that I would like to just share with you here that cover the summary that you have. And this is interesting reading, especially when you start considering House Memorial 1. First of all, the part of the elements of the bill, it will increase the amount of natural gas production in the Intermountain West. As you saw from Mr. Kirshner's slides, that is everything west of the Mississippi, mainly out of the Rocky Mountain area, which has huge gas resources. Second thing it will do, this bill will attempt to do, is boost imports of liquefied natural gas by facilitating construction of new import terminals, of which Oregon has a couple of sites, maybe more, and by improving the coordination of federal permits on for pipelines that transport natural gas from LNG terminals. It will create a framework of constructive discussions about environmentally responsible development of natural gas resources on the outer continental shelf, such as giving the Interior Secretary the ability to issue natural gas-only leases and enabling governors to request that the federal government prepare an estimate of natural gas and or oil resources that lie just off our coastline. An additional thing it will do is promote innovative technologies such as natural gas fuel combined heat and power systems. which generate electricity on the premises of factories, hospitals, retail stores, nursing homes, and other commercial facilities, while recycling once wasted heat for other uses, such as space heating and water heating. This is being used today, and it's high-end cost, but the technology is there. Another item, they will encourage customers to use natural gas more efficiently. This is something that our companies continue to do day in and day out, is the conservation of the use of the fuel. Finally, they will promote a diverse mix of fuels for electricity generations, such as through the proposed National Coal Gasification Strategy for the power sector. Now, those are the main bullet points of what that piece will attempt to do. And if you would like some light reading, you can get it up on the net. It's a 251-page bill. But Congress never does anything that doesn't weigh about 4 pounds per piece. So with that, I know you've heard enough from the three of us. We'll entertain any further questions you might have, and then we'll allow our compatriots to go ahead.
Okay. I think we will let you be participants by listening now. Mr. Rush, I'd like to come forward with TransCanada. Welcome. I'm glad you could be with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm glad to be here. My first time in Salem, I have to say, so pleased to be here.
Would you give your name for the record?
Oh, pardon me. My name is Jeff Rush, R-U-S-H. I'm the Vice President and General Manager of TransCanada's Gas Transmission Northwest Pipeline System and North Baja Pipeline System, which I'll describe to you a little bit. Thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion with you, and I'll go as quickly as I can, pending your questions. I can talk a little bit about some of the questions you asked in the last session, if you'd like. First of all, I'll talk about why how TransCanada is involved. There's a pipeline that delivers gas from the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, which is a very large basin of natural gas and oil, second biggest on the continent next to the Gulf region. It delivers gas to a lot of different parts of North America, but for this discussion, there's a pipeline that brings the gas from that basin, from basically the Idaho-Canada border, down to Northern California, which is a huge consumer of natural gas. And it goes through the states of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. That pipeline is best known as a pipeline called Pacific Gas Transmission, or PGT, and it was owned by Pacific Gas and Electric, or affiliates of Pacific Gas and Electric, until last November, at which time TransCanada, which is the pipeline at the other end of this pipe, bought it from the in the bankruptcy process of a company called NEGT, which is a PG&E affiliate. So nothing really has changed except the ownership. That pipeline is attached to the TransCanada pipeline at the northern end and the PG&E pipeline at the southern end, and has been since 1961. A little bit of gas comes out of the pipeline to serve the utilities along the way in eastern and central Washington, Spokane area, this part of Oregon, I believe. But by and large, the vast majority of that gas goes straight into California from Canada. Most of the gas that serves the populated part of these states, the I-5 corridor, actually comes from British Columbia. But we can talk more about that if you like. TransCanada is a very big company that only does natural gas, high-pressure natural gas transmission pipelines and power plants. I know this slide is a little bit frenetic, and we'll get to a simpler one soon. The circles with the squiggles on them are power plants, and they're all the ones that TransCanada owns. We do what we consider niche power development, and we have really, we would say, the question about how much does it cost to develop power, how much does it cost to produce power, is dependent on your fuel source. And we have fuel sources of every kind. We have nuclear power, We have biomass, which is quite interesting in British Columbia. In fact, that plant burns all of the pulp that's produced in British Columbia, and it burns all of the old railway ties in British Columbia. It burns all of the marijuana that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police obtained. And that's all it burns is biomass.
Better not.
Yeah, don't ask that.
I've been trying to get a tour there myself, actually, but I haven't been able to. We have hydropower, of course, coal and natural gas-fired power. And really, I think the answer to the question is it depends on what the fuel is for your power plant. And I think we could say, generally speaking, hydropower is the cheapest way to produce power because the fuel is free, in quotation marks. If you don't, the whole question of the environmental cost is separate from that. But just the cost of the facilities, we would say hydropower, generally speaking, is the cheapest. Fossil fuel sort of power, maybe next, maybe nuclear power next, and then fossil fuel power. And the alternatives so far, things like wind power, are so far the most expensive sort of power to produce. The problem with wind power is the wind doesn't always blow. And you can't really say to, you know, the hospital that's taking your power, well, you're just going to have to hold that surgery until the wind starts to blow again because, you know, obviously some of these things can't wait. So what you do when you build wind power is you have to have backup gas-fired power, coal-fired power, or whatever it is, and then you might as well have just built that to begin with from an economic point of view, although there are lots of different considerations.
Jeff, you said hydro was the cheapest, and then...
I think I would say nuclear. I'll have to look that up.
Okay.
I think I would say
then fossil fuels?
Then fossil fuels, and there will be an argument about whether coal is cheaper than gas, etc. And so far, alternatives would be the most expensive, although that can obviously change as technologies improve. This slide just illustrates, all the red white you see on this slide, I think, is the GTN pipeline, Gas Transmission Northwest Pipeline, which is the pipeline we've been talking about that connects Western Canadian Gas to California and some of the local utility companies along the way. Basically, we would say that the high price of natural gas is... While we would hesitate to call it an aberration, it's higher than it will be in the future. It's a normal, it's a manifestation of a market that works well, actually. And what's happening in the marketplace now is demand is getting ahead of supply. Supply has been able to enjoy, the producers, especially in Western Canada in the past 30 years, have been able to enjoy cheap production costs because they found all the gas that's easy to find, and so it's been cheap. But there's still lots of gas there, and there's abundant sources of gas in the world. In fact, North America has about 3% of the gas reserves on a worldwide basis, but consumes about 20% of the gas that gets consumed in the world on a daily basis. So sooner or later, that's when we're going to have to pay for that. And sooner or later, that means gas is going to have to come to North America from other parts of the world. And there's lots of gas in the world, and there's lots of gas in places where they can't use it. And you can buy it fairly cheaply. Places like Trinidad, Malaysia, Indonesia. Those are places that... apart from power, they just don't have the heating requirements that we have here in the northern part of North America. They have a lot of gas. So apart from their own power demand, they can afford to export it, and they can export it quite cheaply. I haven't looked at the price in the past couple of years because I'm not in that part of the business now, but a couple of years ago, you could buy it for less than a dollar. A gas here, the same amount of gas here would cost $7. So you have to think about the cost of getting it from wherever you're getting it to North America. But by and large, we would say that liquefied natural gas can land on the shores of the of North America for $3.50, $4, that sort of price range, and the producer can make money on it. When more gas gets to the market, the price of gas will come down. Either that, more supply has to come in, or the demand has to drop off in order to get the price down. So I'm showing you this graph to show you another source of natural gas, which are what we call the northern pipelines. One of them comes, the one on the right, the dotted line, comes from the Canadian north in an area called Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk in northern Canada, which is where I've been spending all of my time in the past 3 years. So thank you very much for bringing me to Portland. That amount of gas that can move there would be about 2% of the North American market today. And then there's the Alaskan gas pipeline, which we would say would be about 10% of the American market today if that gas was flowing. Those pipelines don't exist, and there are those natural gas pipelines don't exist, and there are plenty of battles raging about who should, commercial battles raging and political, about who should build them and when they should get built. Right now we're forecasting the Canadian pipeline to be built by 2010, the Alaskan pipeline, most forecasts would say 2014. That one's a little bit more difficult. It was permitted, actually, in the early 70s by President Carter and Prime Minister Trudeau, but still not built yet. But lots of gas up there when we can figure out a way to get it to the market, and that will help to bring prices down also.
Considering that we would eventually be using, or we are using 3%, how long would that supply last? Are we talking about decades?
Oh yeah, we would think that quite a long time. Up until the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, Canadian producers were forced to have 25 years worth of gas in their inventory. So every year they had to show the government, I have 25 years worth of gas in their inventory. NAFTA took that requirement away. They still have 9 or 10 years worth of inventory, but we would say decades and decades at least. Here's another interesting statistic that I know for Canadian gas and oil, that all of the energy that's been produced there is less than 20% of the energy that exists in those points. In other words, when you drill a well, you find the reserves of gas and oil, you take the part that's easiest to get at, which is what's happened over the last 60 or 70 or 80 years in that particular pool, and you leave the rest because there's easier gas to get at 10 miles down the road. And so there's a lot of oil and gas there, and people know where it is. It's just a question of getting it out of the ground, and that's more difficult the deeper it is or the kind of geology it exists in. But it's there, and prices at these levels will encourage the technologies to develop to get that gas out of there. This is the GTN pipeline, again built in 1961, or the original part of it built in 1961. Very big pipeline by North American standards. Excellent safety record, very well maintained. We're very pleased to have it in our portfolio of assets, and expect it to be there for quite a long time. You can see it comes through the less populated parts of Washington and Oregon. The red pipelines are pipelines, transmission pipelines, basically, that belong to others. And most of the I-5 corridor comes from British Columbia. We would say, we've often wondered from Calgary, actually, why there isn't a pipeline, more pipelines that connect the blue pipeline to the I-5 corridor. I think there will be something, both a pipeline from the blue pipeline to the Seattle area and one to the Portland area. I just draw your attention to the inset graph on the right called North American demand, and you can see it's relentlessly increases. You can see it in the SUVs on the road. You can see it in the size of the houses in Portland, at least, which is the only area of this area that I'm a little bit familiar with. The demand for gas is going up, and mostly that's driven by the demand for electric power. And no turnaround in sight. Most of these basins, the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin and the Gulf Coast basins, we would say, are flat-ish at best going out over the next 10 years or so. Hence the need for it to either find some more supply somewhere else, and people will look to the north. That northern pipeline that's shown is just the Canadian portion, because this forecast has the Alaskan pipeline being built by 2016, just outside of the forecast window. But all of the basins, basically flat, except the Rockies Basin, which is growing nicely, although if you added it together with the San Juan and Permian and Mid-Continent Basins, it more than offsets those declines, but not by very much. So for sure we'll have this situation for quite a long time to come in terms of demand being robust and supply struggling to keep up. This is just another way to look at that same graph. This is the very top of the graph is the demand line, and the colors are the way that that was supplied over the years. So you're seeing the Gulf of Mexico, gas coming from the Gulf of Mexico starting to drop off between 2005 and 2015. Western Canadian gas flat at best for the next 5 years, starting to drop a little bit. The Canadian Northern Pipeline that I talked about, you can barely see it there. So that's about 65 billion cubic feet of gas per day is consumed in North America right now, and that pipeline is 1 billion cubic feet a day. And the Alaskan pipeline will be 5 or 6 billion cubic feet a day. One other thing just to think about, interesting thing in terms of the way gas is produced, is I think of it like a bathtub that is full of water and the drain is open. If you want to keep the water level the same, you have to open the tap. And that's what happens with North America, with all gas and oil production. The decline rate is about 20%. So you have to find 20% more gas every year just to keep the level the same. And the level's not staying the same, of course. The demand is growing. And that's why the price is getting so high.
Jeff, is the LNG, the spike at the end, they're growing. That's coming from Indonesia and Malaysia and Trinidad.
Russia, the Sakhalin Islands in Russia, there apparently is going to be there is a lot of gas there, and apparently the Russians are going to liquefy it and ship it out into the world. And this projection is, again, the top of that line, the top of the purple line is the demand line. And we have filled it in with LNG because we don't know what else to put there. So we assume that if we're going to meet that demand, we, North America, are going to meet that demand. It's got to come from North America. Either that or the demand line needs to turn down. And it will if prices stay high enough long enough.
Okay.
So this is my concluding slide. You know, the real perspective that I'd like to leave you with is demand is getting ahead of supply now, and that's what's driving the high price. We think the prices will come down. They might not ever come down to the levels we enjoyed for most of the last couple of decades. They'll come down lower than what they're now on an average basis over the next couple of decades. But the traditional basins are struggling to keep up. And if we're going to get the price down, we need to find some other ways to either curtail the demand or bring new supply into the market. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair. Are there any known supplies off the coast, Pacific?
There certainly are off the coast of British Columbia. Now, I don't know off the coast of Washington and Oregon, but certainly there are a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of known supply because the province doesn't allow exploration there. But there's suspected to be an awful lot of supply off the British Columbia coast. And how far south that comes, I don't know.
All right, thank you very much. Jeff, appreciate your coming and presenting this very interesting information. We have with us Roger Martin from Martin Associates, and seeing as they have the major pipeline in Oregon, I'm going to ask him to come up and speak as well.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Williams Company, the Northwest Pipeline. I didn't intend to testify, and you heard all you need to hear about gas supplies, but I did want to correct one thing. The previous witness stated that the red line on the map he showed you, which is two lines, one from northeast Washington down to the Hermiston area and across the Columbia River and down the Ohio Valley, and a line that runs through Representative Jensen's district down into Idaho. That's the Williams Company, and they will be massively surprised to find out they're a distribution company. We're the largest gas transmission company in Oregon, and we serve the majority of the residential load in Oregon. The two transmission lines are very important. I just wanted to make sure you understood there were two transmission lines in the state, one by Northwest and one by the previous. The other thing I did want to bring to your, or to answer two questions. One was raised by you, Mr. Chairman, about where's the best place to put an electrical generating plant? And ideally, the best place is right next to the load. And because the heavy loads are in the Willamette Valley, the best place to have these generating plants would be in the Willamette Valley. That would be if everyone accepted that. But the majority of these are built in rural Oregon and represented Jensen's district because there's less objection to having the line. From there, you have to run transmission, electrical transmission lines. And one of my clients is the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. We're in the process of developing a very large 1,200 megawatt, probably, generating plant using natural gas. And the biggest single stumbling block to get that plant off the ground is no capacity on Bonneville's lines. We're going to have to build about a $70 million section of increased capacity on Bonneville's transmission lines in order to get the electricity of the Willamette Valley. So it would be wonderful if you could put the plants here, but that's an ideal world. The other thing, and Representative Girard brought up, and I do think it's a very important point, is the whole issue of sabotage of criminal activity. We live in a country that has been generally very trusting of everyone, and there has not been a great deal of time and effort put into the whole issue of security. And you are entirely right. The transmission lines, both electrical and gas, run through massive rural areas of Oregon. I just drove down through Lake County last. There are miles where you're driving alongside the intertide of California. There's no one there. And evil minds could devise all kinds of bad things to happen. So security is extremely important. And these, although for the most part these transmission lines are buried 6 or 8 feet under the ground, there are pumping. The last slide that he just showed you showed a series of pumping plants. And where they emerge, it doesn't take an evil mind very long to figure out where those are. And I think there needs to be a great deal of effort put into the whole security thing, because it looks like we're going to have bad people around us who would like to do very bad things to us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Yeah, you were right. All of us know we got to.
We will now move to House Memorial 1, and I'll call Matt Marquis. Guess you're alone today. Good to have you with us. I'm sorry. Yes. We'll open a public hearing on House Memorial Number 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the American Chemistry Council, which is a nationwide kind of an umbrella group made up of plastic, chemical, and vinyl resin companies, all of which are high users of natural gas. The American Chemistry Council has been trying to introduce and pass this memorial in as many states as possible. Currently, I think they're at over 20 states. I'm not an expert at natural gas by any stretch of the imagination, but I think you've heard a lot of information already today about natural gas. I do want to say this memorial encourages kind of four main points. First, boosting supply. We would like to see this done domestically, but when and where appropriate and when necessary, importation makes a lot of sense. You've already heard a lot about liquefied natural gas, and this could be a very cost-effective way to help with our natural gas supply here in the U.S. Secondly, it encourages conservation and efficiencies. Over the short term, demand can be reduced with high-end efficiency standards and incentives. Thirdly, it helps encourage increasing fuel diversities, and this includes all forms of power generations, not just hydro, nuclear, or coal, but also includes wind, solar, geothermal, landfill gas, or even synthetic gases. Lastly, it encourages the building of needed infrastructure. The American Chemistry Council's goal is to help keep an affordable supply of natural gas for everyone here in the United States. With that, Mr. Chair, like I've said earlier, you've heard a lot of information already about natural gas, but I think I'll stop here and try to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gray.
Just out of curiosity, is there any kind of exploration within the gas exploration going on within the United States?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, honestly, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't have an answer for that. I don't know.
Might have been a better question for the other group, but
I'm sure that they could answer
it. I just thought of it.
All right. Any other questions?
Thank you,
Matt.
Sir.
Anyone else would like to testify on this issue? All right. Hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Memorial Number 1 and open a work session on House Memorial 1. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Memorial 1 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right.
I'm ready for that motion.
Any discussion? Representative Barnard.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused, and maybe without a good reason, perhaps. We passed in various committees House Memorial, House Joint Memorial, a variety of other titles. I take it that this memorial is intended to go just to the House and not to the Senate. I'm wondering what the reason for that might be. If we were going to ask Congress to do something, wouldn't it have more impact if we had it going through both houses, or have I simply misunderstood and this is going to the Senate?
I think my only answer that I have, I have nothing specific on this. Remember last session I had a memorial on timber operations that we wanted basically to send to Congressman Walden, who was working on those issues at the time, and I think that was just the idea to collect the House's opinion on it and send it back to the Congress. I don't think there's anything other than that I know of. Anybody else have any impressions?
Obviously, the House's opinion is more important than.
Don't tell them that.
I'll accept that.
While we're here, we will.
All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Let's have a call of the roll.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Is that an abstain, or is that a need more time?
I need more time.
Okay.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Anderson?
Chair votes aye.
Chair, I'll also vote aye.
All right. The House Memorial Number 1 has gained a majority and is hereby declared passed. I'll close the work session on House Memorial 1, and just a little housekeeping, I guess. We had intended to bring up House Memorial 3. It has been postponed. Probably within the next few weeks we should hear it. If not, we'll be heard.
Just assign a carrier.
Is this going to be on the consent calendar?
I know Representative Barnhart doesn't want to carry it.
Why not put it on the consent?
I think we'll run the consent calendar. Do I hear any objection to running HM1 on the consent calendar? All right, so moved. So passed. We had an interesting meeting at Portland State last 2 days ago. And I frankly was a little bit disturbed, and it became quite disturbed at the end of the meeting when we found information that basically linked a group that came to film the whole session, not just a piece of it like the media normally does, but 3.5 hours of testimony. There were a number of scripted questions throughout the audience and others. The information that that I came across at the end was not to be distributed to anyone but the cameraman, who evidently was hired out of New York, flown down from Seattle, hired a camera and a videographer, and took a film of the whole proceedings. We had a hard time finding out who they were from. They really didn't want to mention who sent them or who paid for them or what auspices they have. They refused to really give us much information. But since the time of the meeting, I found out from some of those who came to testify that they had been followed across the country by different groups like this, and they are evidently pointing toward making a film. I don't want to tie it to, but it's similar to what Michael Moore was doing during the campaign, making a film called Melting Planet. It's funded by evidently by George Soros and moving on. And so I was really kind of disturbed that there would be that kind of a move without being very open and very honest about who they were. There were a number of folks in the audience, one of whom was, I think, pretty much the mover and shaker on our end of the testimony of the hearing, professor at Lewis and Clark. He was asked to ask specific questions, which were not necessarily directly related to the subject matter at hand, but more to finances and other issues around our hearing. And so until the time that I can get more information on what their intent was, what their obvious bias was, we're going to hold off on HM3, and we will hear that at a later point when I have more to tell you about what was going on. But with that, I think we've come to the end of our agenda, and we'll close the Environment Committee. We are adjourned. Thank you all.